The first is entrepreneurship and self-employment. So in rich countries like the United States, you know, the entrepreneurship component is more higher end businesses, creativity, innovations, that area, whereas in poor countries, it's really more sustainable self-employment when there are few paid options available. So I'm looking at ways to help women in richer countries, gain access to better opportunities and loans, and in poor countries, ways to move them from very marginalized self-employment with very low earnings into better earnings opportunities as self-employed women.
Are the barriers to that still largely cultural in both contexts, or are they more than that?
Yeah, I think in both contexts, probably the main barrier is access to funding and access to loans, that even women in the U.S. find they have more trouble getting good loans compared to men. And in poor countries, also, women are credit constrained, often because they don't have any collateral. They don't own land. They don't have title to any land, so they have nothing to put up for collateral. So I'd say probably the biggest constraint in both kinds of countries, rich and poor, is women's access to credit as a big constraint to entrepreneurship and self-employment.
Do women have a similar lack of collateral in developed countries?
No. We see more women, who have formal credit histories and they have collateral.
Then why can't they get loans?
Names on property titles and deeds, and especially credit histories, whereas in poor countries it's not as common to find people with extensive credit histories, especially women.
Then why can't they get loans in developed countries?
In richer countries?
Yeah.
That's when banks are making decisions on what they expect to be more profitable, and there could still be some bias that the companies that men are starting are they expect to be more profitable, so men are more likely to get the bigger loans.
Are they starting different kinds of companies, or is that just an assumption on the parts of banks?
In terms of the main difference, I believe, is size. Both in rich and poor countries, women tend to start smaller businesses with just a couple of employees, if any, and men tend to start bigger companies, or they grow more quickly. The second big area is agriculture and gender gaps in agriculture and in farming. And, that's especially relevant in poor countries. So one of the key things that we've seen in many developing countries is this productivity gap between male and female farmers. But study after study shows that once women are given access to the same inputs, the same amount of fertilizer, the same kinds of pesticides, the same kind of training, and the same access to land, then they're just as efficient as male farmers. So women are really no less efficient. They have inequitable access to these inputs into farming.
Well, access to land and land ownership, though, is a huge barrier in many countries.
Again, so land keeps coming up in these, first two cases. It matters for collateral and it matters for agricultural productivity. And then the third area of women's empowerment in the labor market, I look at, it holds again for rich countries like the U.S. and in poor countries, is access to high-paying jobs and equal opportunities across the occupation spectrum. And I look at policies that support women in the labor market, including enforcement of equal pay, enforcement of equal opportunity, and then different kinds of social policies that level the playing field and that make it easier for working mothers to, compete on an equal basis in the labor market.
In a developing nation, it's very difficult for that to happen, though. It's not like you're in Sweden where there is state-funded daycare from cradle onward.
That is correct, but many developing countries have almost the same kind of labor standards that we see in the U.S., you know, Labor Standards Act. But the main difference in developing countries is that they're not being enforced, and sometimes egregiously. So you still see these factory fires and building collapses and very low wages. So as a starting point in poor countries, we really need to have governments enforcing their labor standards. And I do take a stand on corporate codes of conduct. You know, when corporations try to enforce their own labor standards, I don't think it's effective, and I'm quite skeptical of corporate codes of conduct.
Where are the government incentives to enforce those codes when they're producing either backsheesh in a culture that is not healthy, or producing tax revenue in a culture that is slightly more healthy? Many developing nations, though, are not democracies, or their institutions, if they are democracies, are not strong enough to overcome corruption or the needed tax revenue from a business that is not enforcing labor codes.
Yeah, that is true. And then sometimes, you know, consumer pressure can help. You know, put pressure on companies, and then you go the corporate way in terms of trying to enforce. But ultimately, it really is up to governments. I don't think we can trust profit-maximizing companies to say that they really are trying to get the best for workers in a poor country. What they're trying to do is maximize profits.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Jana Rogers, a feminist economist and World Bank consultant who's going to deliver the Eckley Lecture on Economics at Illinois Wesleyan University. You had mentioned policies that tend to encourage access to capital for women. What are some of those?
I would say in low-income countries, one of the policies reforms that I push strongly is land titling policies in which women get their names on titles to land. A good example was in Vietnam. For a long time, they have these land use certificates with one space on them for one name in a household. So that would be for the head of the household, who's usually a husband. About 10, 15 years ago, they added two spaces to these land titles, these land use certificates. So now all of a sudden women have their names on property titles. And research that I've done has shown a number of effects on women's empowerment, on their bargaining power in the household, and on even the health of their children. And we also saw in India with a rural banking reform where villages now got bank branches, there was a bigger effect on women's entrepreneurship than there was on men's entrepreneurship. So different kinds of reforms, either, you know, land titling, or in the case of India, what they did was require any commercial bank that wanted to open up a new branch in a city, they had to open up 4 branches in rural villages. So that was also very successful in getting credit out to poor areas, and especially for women.
As a sidebar question here, was there an impact on the hollowing of rural areas from that bank branch law? If you can get credit, you can make a more sustainable business regardless of gender in a rural area, and it may limit the impulse to urbanize.
The other studies that have looked at that rural banking reform have found a decrease in poverty in the villages that got more rural banks. So I think that's related to what you're saying, that these, you know, very remote areas saw less poverty, which implies, you know, less of a need for people to leave to find a better way of life in cities. But that's an interesting question. What happened to rural urban migration in the case of these village banks coming? I think you just came up with an interesting research question.
Glad to help. Well, how much did it move the needle on women's access to capital, having bank branches? What sort of metrics are you discovering?
Yeah. What we looked at, my co-author and I, was in surveys, you know, women say if they're working or not and what kinds of work they do. And we found a positive effect of the rural banking reform on women's self-employment, which was, you know, the kind of language they use for women's entrepreneurship. And these are very small-scale businesses, but women are now more self-sufficient and they're selling goods and services. They're little businesses, but before they were not working at all. And we did not see this kind of effect for men, which implies that men already had access to capital, and these rural bank branches did not make a significant impact for men, but it did make a significant impact for women.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with the Eckley Lecturer on Economics at Illinois Wesleyan University this year, Yana Rogers. Let's go back to the Vietnam example, the simple change in a bureaucratic form, increasing, you said, the bargaining power within the household, presumably because these women are also having title and also then getting access to loans and starting businesses as well.
Exactly.
What's the cultural impact of that? I know I shouldn't be asking an economist that, but certainly you might have noticed something.
I think what we're finding overall is that it's a positive impact, that women have more clout in household decisions that benefit their children and that benefit, you know, social spending in the household. We're not the only ones that have found this. A number of studies have found that an additional dollar in the hands of women tends to get spent more on resources that benefit children, like food and healthcare and schooling supplies. An additional dollar in the hands of men tends to be spent on adult substances like cigarettes and alcohol. And this kind of finding across a number of countries has prompted some now very famous programs in developing countries called conditional cash transfer programs, where cash is transferred to women only, and it's conditional on certain requirements that they take their children to health clinics or enroll them in school. But the cash goes specifically to women because of this kind of research.
Let me ask then what you think the impact will be of President Trump's executive order barring aid to organizations that provide health services in developing nations if they also offer abortion services.
And it's not even abortion services. Apparently, the order affects any health provider that even mentions the word abortion. They don't have to necessarily provide services. If they even mention the word abortion in their literature, they are susceptible to having their funding cut. I think we're going to see more women being denied access to contraception. So there's going to be more unwanted pregnancies and then unsafe abortions, or women giving birth in unsafe conditions. And in some countries that are really poor, getting pregnant can be like a death sentence for women in countries that have very high maternal mortality rates. So this policy, and I believe President Bush also passed it. My understanding is that Trump's version is even more extreme than what Bush passed, and it can have life or death consequences for women